Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left in Capital Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm fine, except for the barrage of hateful emails that I received.
Why are you receiving barrage of hateful emails besides the ones from me?
I went on a little motorcycle vacation recently, and I went from Montana all the way down into Wyoming, Idaho, Utah, and out to Colorado, mm-hmm. and I made some disparaging remarks about the food in the middle of the country.
Yes, you did.
Well, there are a lot of people who serve good food in the middle of the country who evidently listen to this show.
You've upset some folks besides me again, have you?
I have a heartfelt apology. One town that I didn't diss when I said that I had passed through Jackson Hole, Wyoming, but didn't mm-hmm. have a chance to stop. That's supposed to be a real culinary capital. I had some bad meals out there.
You did,
but I didn't do my research. I didn't, you know.
Should have brought your copy of Road Food.
You're right. It was about the motorcycle.
Jen and Michael Stern. They have this little book out. We've talked to them about 2-3 times on the show.
It's on our site.
They have a book called Road Food. It's all about the interesting little places. Places across the country and interesting little towns.
I didn't want to do that. Well, here's the deal. It was about the journey. It was about the roads we were on. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about and my friend, we weren't really looking for. It wasn't a food vacation, which is unusual for me.
I think it might be your first one in 20 years. Yeah, that wasn't a food vacation.
But we did. We stopped in Salt Lake City, where I got an email. The best Zagat restaurant in Salt Lake is supposed to be amazing. Next time I'm there, I promise, I will try it. I didn't know we had listeners in Lost in Salt Lake.
Apparently we do.
I'll be there. So, but I stopped at this luncheonette, and I was on my way, and I spent a morning, and I just got food that was. I mean, it was. I ordered chicken cordon bleu. I've been to France, man.
Come on. If you stopped in a diner in the middle of New Jersey,
it's true.
And ordered chicken cordon bleu, you'd get some frozen Happy Meal like chicken cordon bleu with.
That
you know,
would have been much better than what I got, which would have been
cheeseless
much,
cheese food in the middle,
which would have been much better than what I got in Salt Lake City. It was crazy. And my friend who's traveling with me, he lives in Ireland. He ordered a Spanish omelet, and he said the same thing. I've been to Spain, and it was a scrambled egg with a dollop of tomato paste on top. It was really something
wow.
else. Holy
That's
cow.
That's interesting.
All right, let's talk about good and wholesome food. So my apologies. I didn't do my research on this trip in the middle of the country, and I know there's great pie in the middle of the country, there's great barbecue in the middle of the country, that we know, but there's also other stuff that I didn't find. So I take mm-hmm. back all of my remarks. Sort
all of.
Of
them?
Sort of.
Except for the tomato paste one you just
yeah.
made again.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to upset whomever else you might have not offended the first time.
There was a great article. I'm not really good at apologies, am I? There was a great article in The Times by Randy Kennedy talking about staff meal at per se.
I'm not sure that everybody knows what staff meal or family meal is.
Well, I'm not sure everybody knows what per se is. Per se is one of the top restaurants in the world. It's located in Manhattan, and it's owned by a great chef named Thomas Keller, who owns restaurants in just a couple of restaurants in San Francisco and in New York. We've eaten at both of his restaurants, and they are amazing. Lunch at these restaurants is $200, $250.
And for those of you who are not in the business and may not know, a lot of great restaurants, I say most of the great restaurants, one of the things that we do before each shift or at the end of each shift, some places do, is we'll sit down together and we'll share a meal. We'll have a meal together where we'll eat and we'll talk about either what's just happened in the course of the evening or what's about to happen in the course of the evening and kind of prep ourselves for the evening's events.
And this is a very European tradition in Europe, and all the restaurants, they have this. And because in Europe, the restaurants would traditionally in the past have always been open for lunch, and then there's a break, mm-hmm. and then you come together for staff meal, and then you have dinner. It's also called family meal. because basically you work very in very intense environment with a lot of adrenaline with these people during service. And this is a time to sit down and, you know, obviously if you work in a restaurant, you work in a great restaurant, you're a foodie. You're about food. And you know, we're going to be providing great meals for people all night long. This is a chance to sit down. And we've evolved over the years, and we're still trying to make our family meal better and better and interesting and really a part of a positive part of our employees' day.
And generally what we'll do during family meal, it'll range anywhere from 25, 30 minutes to sometimes as much as 45 or 50 minutes. And in order to separate the two kinds of things that we do at family meal. And the first part of which is the learning experience, where we'll talk about the food or the wine, or maybe we'll do a little tasting of wine or something like that. But the other half of that is the truly the family meal time, where we'll sit down, we'll eat, maybe we'll share some anecdotal or funny stories about the day before or the weeks before, and we'll talk a little bit about just our lives in general and spend some time together.
And, you know, I find that restaurants that and many fast food or pub kind of places don't do this. And there have been times when in the summer in the past before, I mean, Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi are pretty busy now with we have a hotel across the street. We're busier 12 months a year now. But in the beginning, 10 years ago, we were slower in the summer. And what a lot of restaurants do that are either very busy and not on the high end or we even did when we were slower is you would have people stagger in, you know, as you got busier. So some people would come in at 4 and set up, and other people wouldn't come until 5, and then the late waiter might not come until 6 or 6:30. There's a real detriment to that. I mean, my cousin owned a bar that I worked in for a long time, and that was sort of how it worked. And you could get a meal. You were entitled when you came in to order off a limited section of the menu or to have some staff meal.
I worked in restaurants like that, too.
But there's a great loss to that. I mean, when we sit down as a cohesive unit, and it's a way to bond, to communicate, to come together.
It's definitely a way to call each other out.
Absolutely.
If you did something wrong, or perhaps even the evening before after work, if you did something kind of without great discretion, you'll be called out for it at staff meal the next day.
And you know, when Mark says we'll do some wine tasting, we'll crack a bottle of wine. Now maybe we'll crack a bottle of wine for 15 people, and we'll pour it and taste it and have it with our food and talk about it. And the sommelier will talk about it, or I'll talk about it, or Mark will talk about it. And it's not a matter of this is on special, let's hawk this tonight. It's a matter of here's something new, here's something we haven't heard about. Because I think in a great restaurant, you want people who love food. You don't want people who are reading something by rote that they memorized off a special card that they have no experience of. I think.
Well, and there's no better way to learn than experientially. That's how you remember. That's how you learn. Those are the kinds of things that you remember for the longer time.
Well, and I'll recommend a book that's actually a great book. Chanterelle Restaurant was the first is a restaurant in New York that we love. Roger DeGorn is the sommelier there. He's a friend of ours, and they have it's owned by a husband and wife, and they published a cookbook called Family Meals, and it's about their family meals. And if you have a restaurant,
and the Waltucks have been doing this family meal thing for a long time, even longer than we have at Stage Left,
and they were actually, when that book came out, was an inspiration for us to sort of kick it up. One of the things that they point out is that they use the new line cook in a lot of these restaurants, and per se as well, and they'll say, okay, you're making family meal tonight. And it's a way to test a line cook. And if you throw together some rice in a pan or throw some wings in a pan and heat them up, well, what does that say about you as a cook and what you care about food? And it's a great way to bring somebody young and new up and have a shared food experience in the beginning of the night. I think the tradition is great. And I think if you want to have a serious restaurant, you better have a serious family meal.
And I enjoy when the chefs show off in family meal. It's fun for everybody. I mean, we all eat at that time, and myself and Francis included.
Well, when we come back, we're going to be talking with Liz Pearson of Savoir Magazine. She is the in charge of the test kitchen at Savoir Magazine, one of our favorite foodie publications. And she's got some interesting stories, I'm sure. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left at Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Liz Pearson is our guest today. She is the test kitchen director of Savoir Magazine, one of our favorite foodie magazines. She's a graduate of the CIA. She was raised in Austin, Texas, where she was a private cook, and she moved to New York, where she freelanced for Savoir and now directs its famous test kitchen.
Liz Pearson, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
You know, we love Savoir Magazine. We've said it a million times before. It's very interesting. It's written on a higher level than most. And you guys have some really interesting foodstuffs. You run the test kitchen. What do you do there in the test kitchen?
Oh, my goodness. Well, Chuck, thanks for the sweet comments. You know, we do all of the recipe testing for recipes that run in the issue and now recipes that actually run on our website as well. We also do a lot of product testing and a lot of tasting, of course, of new things that are out there that get sent to us that we're certainly willing to try and pass around amongst the editors. But we really, you know, we work very hard at testing those recipes and writing them. A lot of research is involved and a lot of crazy ingredients and a lot of crazy methods that are new to us as they come along. So it's a lot of learning.
Well, you guys do use a lot of unique ingredients, and well, some of them are crazy, I agree. But you know, when you read magazines very frequently as consumers, we read a lot of magazines, and so many of the columns are just kind of these flights of fancy. And you can never connect yourself. You'll never get to experience what's actually in those columns. One of the things that I think that Savoir does probably better than any other magazine is you tell the readers how to find the things that they've just been reading about, how they can experience that. And you do that through your section called The Pantry, which is the one you're responsible for, right?
We have, you know, our readers are a completely adventurous bunch. You know, we have, not only do we really try so hard to give really reliable vendors and maybe small batch producers for very special things, I mean, we also give all the information about if you're going to go and you want to try that dish in that actual country, you should go here and try it, and you should also stay here while you're in that country. And we try to give all those details because our readers are really the folks who are going out and doing these things. So in addition to helping them create it at home, we also want to give them the tools to find it in, you know, in their travels.
Because every once in a while I do go to Turkey.
Exactly. But if you don't go to Turkey, then you should absolutely know where to find, you know, really excellent dried peppers that are from Turkey that you can use to make Turkish dumplings. You know, that it shouldn't limit you by being here. You should still be able to travel with food, in a sense, from your own kitchen.
So for Savoir Magazine, when the articles come in from a writer, does it work that the article comes in from the writer, they interview a chef or someone who cooks this cuisine authentically in a specific place, and then you've got to go and find those ingredients either online or New York? How does that work out?
It really, you know, so when a writer submits a story to us, it usually, especially if it's a feature, it's going to have recipes along with it, and those could come from, like you mentioned, a chef. They could also come from maybe the writer's favorite books or even a book that the writer themselves has written. They can also come from, maybe we just know that, for instance, a really great recipe is being made at a restaurant, and maybe the writer couldn't track it down, but then we come in and try to track it down and try to get a hold of them, and if they won't share it, we kind of try to go there and eat it and get to the bottom of the recipe and then develop it a little bit ourselves.
Well, let's hold that right there. I think that's really fascinating. If you're talking about a restaurant recipe, will you go to a restaurant and sort of reverse engineer the dish and try to figure out what they're doing?
Well, 9 times out of 10, we're really lucky in that cooks and chefs and writers are really happy to help us, and that's a great thing, and it's such a gift because there's a lot of really terrific, intricate cuisine out there that's tough even for the most, you know, for a cook that's eaten their whole lives and cooked their whole lives. It's still tough for them to figure it out. So for the most part, they're going to help us, but on occasion, there are times when maybe there's a language barrier, for instance, and we just can't find someone in the kitchen who speaks English well enough to really describe it, or it could be that it's a recipe they've been making for decades and they just really don't want to share it. And I can understand that as a cook. Mm-hmm. So,
do you find that most chefs will give you the recipes, or is it like my grandmother and they'll just take you 90% of the way there and you got to figure out the rest on your own?
It has happened before where cooks or chefs have left things out.
On purpose, you think, or by mistake?
Absolutely on purpose. And, you know, and it's so funny because we had one just recently where it was a very simple recipe, and we made it. You know, I personally made it 3 or 4 times, and it just wasn't working. And I sort of felt like I knew exactly what to do to make it work, and I went over and over with the original cook, are you sure you're not doing it this way, and are you sure? And they just swore up and down that they weren't. Well, it turns out we eventually tasted the actual original dish, and it was a fib. It was a terrible fib.
Well, no,
it's really, it's just between you and me. Why don't you tell us who that chef was?
No. We know you're not going to do that, but
I'm a completely trustworthy cook. I can't, although I'd love to. Trust me.
But so we don't have to talk about the chef, but let's talk about what specifically, what kind of ingredient can be left out, because I know bartenders do this a lot as well. What kind of ingredient was left out in this case that made such a difference in the final dish?
Well, certainly spices and things can be left out. If you're talking about maybe a baking or a pastry recipe, maybe they're using a different kind of leavener or something that's going to totally change, the texture of that cake itself. Also, that they could be, and it happens, sometimes it happens through the fact that they just maybe forgot or got confused, and sometimes they will deliberately leave it out. But occasionally they'll give you the wrong method. Swear up and down that they always make the cake like this, and it turns out that they really don't. They do it a completely different way. But I don't mean to say that 99 out of 100 times these folks are giving us their recipes, and they're doing every single thing they can to help us.
What I think is important to point out to our listeners is that Liz Pearson runs the pantry at Savor Kitchen. This is not a usual thing. Most of the time when you're reading a recipe in a newspaper or in a lot of publications, it's not been tested by that publication. It comes across however the chef presented it, that's how you see it. And this makes a big difference in the usability of those recipes, I think.
Absolutely. And it is really surprising how many cookbooks also that don't ever get tested. And you just hope that you're lucky and have a really fantastic cook who knows their stuff and can really just write them by memory and be accurate. But the test kitchen is really, we find that it's just integral to our process. And there's just, not only do we test these recipes, but then all of our editors are tasting them. So if that editor has been to that country and had that original dish, we're testing to make it match their taste memory.
We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Liz Pearson, in charge of this test kitchen in the pantry at Savor Magazine, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And we're talking with Liz Pearson of Savor Magazine. She runs the test kitchen there and the pantry as well. We were talking about verifying cookbooks. And Liz, before the break, you were saying that some cookbooks even don't get tested. I remember friends of ours, Barbara Shin and David Page from Home Restaurant and now Shin Vineyard out in Long Island, when they wrote their wonderful cookbook, Recipes from Home, it took them years. And David was a chef cooking in the kitchen of Home Restaurant every night. And he still said, I've got to test. The most expensive and grueling part of this was testing these recipes for the home cook and going through, having someone else, hand him the ingredients and make sure that everything was in the book. Because I think a lot of what a chef does or a cook does comes second nature, so you can slip your mind if you're telling somebody how to do it. Is it, what percentage of cookbooks would you think are tested out there?
Oh, gosh. Unfortunately, I wouldn't be the one to answer that, but I can tell you that there are certainly, I still cook from recipes from time to time at home. I still even though we cook all day long, we still cook dinner every night at home, and I'm a Southern girl, and I can't help myself even cooking at home at night. So when I pick up occasional recipes at home, it's gotten to the point where you almost really need to be a pretty good cook to start so that you're making the right assumptions and you're kind of adding in extra little things along the way to make that recipe work. I think there are, just like your friend that you just mentioned, there are folks who are so dedicated to testing their recipes, and thank goodness, it's certainly something that's done for cookbooks. But occasionally you find that you run across books that just recipe after recipe don't work.
Well, it's expensive. It's expensive. In our restaurant. We have to test recipes constantly. But it's even more expensive, I would think, if you're just doing a cookbook.
Absolutely. And it's happened before that we oftentimes we do a book review for each issue, and we will oftentimes run a recipe from that book. Well, it's happened before that there are books that we would have loved to review, but their recipes weren't working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a major requirement for me in cookbooks.
See, cookbooks
should not be in the fiction section of your bookshelf.
Exactly. As much as we love these cookbooks, you really have to, like I said, you have to be somewhat of a seasoned cook to cook from them.
We're going to leave it right there, Liz. We'll be back after the news talking with Liz Pearson of Savoir Magazine, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with Liz Pearson. She is the test kitchen director and director of the pantry at Savoir Magazine. And we're talking with her about what exactly she does there in that Savoir kitchen, testing all of the things that you see in their very accurate and wonderful magazine. I think that a lot of people think of your job, Liz, as a dream job, to take these recipes and when they work, there must be some amazing food that comes out of your kitchen. But I know from my own experience cooking from recipes, there must be some disasters. You got any train wreck stories for us? We all love to hear about a good train wreck.
There are certainly some train wrecks. And for the record, it is a dream job. And I don't forget that. I think of it every day and consider myself incredibly lucky that I get to eat and cook for a living. My history is that I actually started at Savoir Magazine as an intern and then came back as a freelancer, and eventually, I sort of stood there until they finally let me in and became the kitchen director. And, we have...
Sometimes you just got to keep knocking on the door,
exactly.
Liz.
Exactly. Sometimes you just got to keep scrambling eggs and cooking in the kitchen till they let you stay. So, we have certainly have a lot of recipes that are a bit of a mess when they come out. But more so, we tend to have pretty good, solid information coming in, so it's not so often. Usually as a cook, while you're doing that first test, or maybe even before we get to the first test, we can start to alter those recipes a little bit when we see that a disaster might be coming. More oftentimes, occasionally there's something that happens where I can remember, actually, it was back when I was an intern, we were doing this terrific recipe for chow chow, actually, from Pennsylvania Fair, County Fair. And it was this very intricate recipe that went on and on, and it had all these different individual vegetables and all these tiny little knife cuts, and then everything got blanched separately and mixed together with the vinegar solution. And so then you eventually are canning it, and you're making canned chow chow in these big mason jars. And so I can remember that it was actually one of the first times that I had worked on a canning recipe for Savoir and sort of wasn't used to their process, and immediately sort of put these huge, this made quarts and quarts of this chow chow, put it down into the big pot of water to process, and 10 minutes later, when it was ready to pull them out, had realized that I had done something wrong with the bottom of the pot, and long story short, pulled the mason jar up, and the bottom of each mason jar had cracked.
Oh, dear.
A nice, neat crack, and I proceeded to lift up the top of the mason jars and spread the chow chow, hours of work, out into the boiling water and ruin the whole thing, and My immediate concern was how long it was going to take the kitchen director at the time to turn around from her desk and realize what I had just done. And
that you had made chow chow soup.
Exactly. So if you look, there's the recipe for chow chow soup. And no, I'm just kidding. No, we went back and did it correctly. But there's a lot of, I always say to people, you wouldn't believe what happens in the test kitchen. It is the quirkiest, funniest place. And the thing, so oftentimes that's what we see happen with a recipe. Something that's just very comical that may happen with the end result.
Owning a restaurant kitchen, I think that I would indeed believe some of the crazy things that happen
in a test kitchen.
You
would absolutely understand that.
And also owning a restaurant kitchen, which is sort of a test kitchen of its own, I think it's comical when it happens to others.
You have to appreciate that, too. You're absolutely right.
One of our disasters many years ago. We put up a lot of local fruit. We're very local, yeah. Organic, sustainable, and local food is so much the best. And we put up tomatoes and cherries. We're putting up strawberries and all sorts of fruit in the summer to use all year round, so we can have local fruit all year round that we put up. Well, we were experimenting with this years ago, and we were experimenting with a number of different recipes. And of course, as you know, Liz, you can put things up in alcohol, and if you put things up with a certain amount of alcohol and sugar, you don't need to boil them to sterilize them because the alcohol does a lot of that. Sure. But there's a certain minimum level of alcohol that you need for that to happen. So we were sort of playing around with different alcohols to sort of see what the level is. Well, we went a little too low with our first batch, and well, strawberry explosions is what we had. We walked in and it looked like a bomb went off. We're like, what's that noise?
So we opened
the door to the root cellar and we're like, I don't think that worked.
Have you ever gotten a little strawberry juice on your clothes? Have you ever seen, like, boy, that's not gonna be hard to get out.
Well, 20 quarts of it.
That should really be part of my job, actually, is writing a little column in the back about how to get stains out of your clothes.
That would be great.
We're gonna be honest.
How about getting 20 quarts of strawberry schmutz out of your root cellar?
I wouldn't even know where to begin.
With a mop is where you begin.
Because there's glass in there.
Yeah, we've been testing, we've been testing some recipes for making your own root beer.
Oh.
And speaking of explosions, it's such an interesting process. It's not something that I had personally done before. And the process of learning to ferment in a bottle and give people a home version of doing, and this is a great thing, actually, you know, that one of the most important part of our jobs is, of course, translating something that's done in a restaurant kitchen or in a factory or what have you, in a bottling plant in this case, and transferring it to a way that is comfortable for folks to do at home. That's a huge part of what we do in the test kitchen.
So it's
fascinating to learn how things ferment in a bottle and how not to do it.
Liz, we really want to make our own root beer, so after the show's over, you got to tell us how to do it.
Absolutely. We'll keep your eye on the upcoming issues.
Excellent.
So.
Well, now, when you make your own root beer at home, I mean, people may not realize that fermentation is basically any chemical process that produces carbon dioxide is one of the results. So there are non-alcoholic fermentations. You can have a fermentation that doesn't also produce alcohol. Alcoholic fermentation produces alcohol and carbon dioxide. So when people make root beer, it wasn't that they took that CO2 cartridge and you know, ran the root beer syrup in with the seltzer water. They would actually take this sweet syrup and ferment the fermentable stuff would ferment in a sealed container and thereby carbonate the beverage. You're working on recipes for people to be able to do this themselves?
Absolutely. In fact, they aren't going to need any kind of CO2 cartridge. We're doing we did a number of different, you know, sort of tests and tries, but we're actually going to do it with a little bit of dry active yeast.
That's great.
And a good warm environment. And actually, if you let it go long enough, I mean, one of the great things about that recipe is that people will find is that root beer changes its character by the hour.
I'm sure, tremendously.
Yeah, I mean, there's a time to drink it, and it will be true, old-fashioned, very sort of spicy and earthy root beer. If you wait 2 or 3 days, if you wait 5 days, it starts to turn into a less sweet, you know, your yeast and your sugars are acting together. It starts to get less sweet, and it becomes more like beer. And it still has all of those sort of very deep, intense root flavors of the sassafras and the licorice root and all those things, but it starts to become something else. And that is, talk about having a dream job. To be able to sit around and study something like that and watch something, you know, watch a recipe that's very much alive change over a week is just, I mean, we're all a bunch of, cooks and food nerds around here, but to us, that's just amazing. It's been a great process.
Well, the best foods in the world are different day one, day two, day three than they are from day 10. That's what I think the real alchemy in all of this is. I mean, realize when you're talking about, you know, you're talking about how you're making root beer. When you make champagne, there's a very, very cheap way to make champagne, and you make a still wine, and you pump bubbles into it, and that's how you make fake champagne. I don't even want to call it champagne. But the traditional way of making champagne is fermenting in the bottle just like that and capturing that CO2.
Well, and when you talk about foods being alive, I mean, cheeses are alive and change over time. Wine is alive and changes over time. And this root beer. Now, how long does it take to make this root beer?
To actually make it up to the point that it's bottled, it just takes 2 or 3 hours, really. You're kind of making a little bit of an infusion, just like you would a tea, for instance, and then you're going from there, and you're adding in, you know, your sweetener and all that sort of stuff, and then you bottle them. And we wanted to, you know, figure out a way to do it with empty soda bottles, empty plastic soda bottles that people will have around. They don't have to have any bottling equipment or CO2 or all of that, And so then you bottle them, and then you just wait a couple days. You can essentially drink it a day or two later, and it's still going to be rich and slightly fermented. But, of course, your ideal will be a few days into it. The ideal character of that root beer that people are going to be looking for will be a couple days into it. And it's a, you know, it's really, it is something to watch out for, because this recipe in particular, the way that we're doing it, is particularly dark and rich. And, I mean, talk about a root beer float. If you were to pour that over,
awesome.
Terrific vanilla ice cream. I mean, it's just a whole different thing than we're used to tasting in root beers that are on the shelves now.
But the real question is, will it still explode if you drop a Mentos in it?
I think that was Diet Coke.
We haven't done that test in the kitchen yet, but I'm sure that'll be part of the process.
What issue will we see the root beer recipe in?
You will see the root beer recipe in the August and September issue.
Great.
And there you have it, just in time for the fall. Hey, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back talking with Liz Pearson of Savoir Magazine. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're having a lovely conversation with Liz Pearson. She's the director of Savoir Magazine's Test Kitchen and also the pantry section in the back of Savoir Magazine, which if you haven't picked it up, you can find out more about Savoir on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. It's a wonderful resource. It's an interesting read. But the nice thing is, because largely because of the work of Liz, you can go to the back and all the stuff they write about and you read about in the magazine, you can find out sort of how to get in the back of the magazine in a section called The Pantry. Now, talk to us about sourcing those ingredients and trying to help a consumer find wacky ingredients, and there must be some interesting stories from that.
Sure. You know, it's I have to give credit also to our interns, who are very hardworking and who we couldn't do without, because they do so much of the shopping, and they certainly help make a lot of phone calls for
Liz, we have lots of interns working for us, too. We hardly ever give them credit, though.
Well, ours deserve every bit that they get. I mean, they are just wonderful. And in fact, there's actually, we've just started up a kind of a series on the Savoir Kitchen on our website, because there's so much to tell about the shopping process and the sourcing process. So we actually did a little segment on shopping itself, because it's one of those things people just wouldn't believe. Since we're in New York City, we often, when we're sourcing things for the actual recipe testing versus maybe ordering them through mail order to try out for what our readers are going to get, you know, our folks, including myself, are out running around on the New York City subway. And so it's an incredible thing sometimes to have to get on that subway with items that sometimes can't be masked a lot on the subway and to see other people's reactions. So,
For example,
we can, we've certainly told the story before about having eels live. Well, they're not live. They had been taken care of, but they tend to wiggle for a very long time after they're dead. So we've had the eels on the subway. I can remember being on the subway with an octopus.
Well, that's how you know they're fresh. They're still
exactly.
wiggling. Come on.
Exactly. I can remember being on the subway with an octopus. There was also another time when we had to go.
Hold on a second. How did the other people on the subway feel about the octopus being on with them? I go to hockey games sometimes and there's octopuses, but almost never on the subway.
You can tell that folks want to ask. You can tell that they look at you, especially if there's some vendor who doesn't really know your story and maybe puts these things in a clear bag, so you're sort of stuck on the subway. after a while, you learn to carry sort of a canvas farmer's market bag with you everywhere you go so that you can hide your secret ingredients. But I can remember, when we tested this fantastic story about food from Lucknow, which is an area in northern India, and we had all of these goat recipes that we had to test. Well, we ended up ordering so much goat, and we wanted to go to a halal butcher, and we ended up, the testing was so extensive that it made sense to buy the goat in very large portions. So I can remember coming back with an intern at the time from Queens, from this halal butcher, with half a goat on the subway. And you can't hide half a goat.
It doesn't fit in your little shopping bag.
It doesn't. And, you know, you can try to put, you know, bags around at either end, but it's still a goat in the middle, and it's still showing. So it's, you know, I think sometimes we certainly get stopped and asked, you know, what it is that we're doing. But it is there's never a day that doesn't go by that we aren't absolutely laughing our heads off in the kitchen over all these adventures of sourcing.
I remember as a kid being grossed out when Grandpa would come home with, or Grandma would come home from the store with capuzella, and you could actually see the animals' faces kind of pressed against
the
side of the back.
Some of our audience is not Italian. Could you translate capuzella?
Capuzella. It's the head of an animal. It's the head of, generally the head of a goat.
Yeah, I know that. Okay,
but the little face would be kind of pressed up against the side of the bag, and you could kind of see it. And,
you know, I was funny.
I never ate capuzella for that reason. I still don't today.
I was thinking, you know, when you had the half a goat, you should have just had a whole goat and let it there with a bell around its neck. You know,
yeah, we should have just taken care of it right there in the kitchen. No, it was. I mean, the recipes ended up being unbelievable. They were these sort of very intricate, sometimes day-long recipes with this goat, and so I felt like it was such a fantastic way to sort of honor this our Subway companion, if you will. We did amazing things with the meat. It was well worth the trip.
Now, do you, when you source for ingredients, you pointed out something just a moment ago. When you source to test recipes, it sounds like you source as best you can, like a restaurateur. But when you list things in the pantry, your guide to resources in the back of Savoir magazine, you shop like a consumer. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and oftentimes, you know, if things are particularly difficult to source, if it's going to cost $1 million for you to get something, we're going to give people a really good backup so that, you know, if they want to spend $80 on shipping to have some really special seafood come to them, they can. But otherwise, we're also going to give them some other ideas for things they could use to substitute. Mm-hmm. So we're very much, I mean, in the pantry section, it's very much, you know, we list the same places that we are buying those ingredients ourselves. Absolutely.
You know, when Francis and I, one of the best parts of our job, one of the most fun parts of our job, but I think one of the most important parts of our job is doing exactly what you're doing, sourcing those kinds of ingredients. But the best times that Francis and I think have had in our business lives have been when we've gotten to travel to faraway places, whether it be California or someplace in the Midwest or Europe or wherever else we're going to source those ingredients. Do you get to do that? Do you get to go off to some of these faraway romantic places?
We're very lucky, all of us here, that we have some extraordinary travels. And I don't go on trips necessarily specifically just to source, but certainly every single trip that I'm on, whether it's a personal trip or a work trip,
I promise not to tell the IRS that it's not completely about business.
Well, I'm always keeping my eyes out. In other words, if I'm going to go to France and maybe research another story, while I'm there, I'm always going to be looking for sources for products that we use often, for new products. I don't think any of us ever leave our town without keeping our eyes open for other things. We have, we have vendors that we always like to use, and there's certainly places that supply us with our produce, and we list them often, let's say, in pantry. But we're also always looking for new folks, and maybe the small guy who's doing something particularly well, and it's really worth sending the business to him.
Well, I'll tell you, Liz, we use Savoir as a resource. We look at it for ideas sometimes for our show, and
we read it for fun.
And it's current and wonderful, and it's very, very accurate, and that's largely due to your efforts. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for being with us today, Liz.
Liz Pearson is the kitchen director of Savoir Magazine. You can check out Savoir. Find it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. It's a great thing to subscribe to. Mark and I do. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. We were talking with Liz Pearson of Savoir Magazine. She had some great advice. I meant to speak to her while she was on the air. She had some great advice that she gave. In the back of Savoir, they have this pantry section where they tell you where to find these ingredients. She has a great piece of advice for shopping in ethnic grocery stores. So, you know, you're reading the magazine, you come up with this ingredient that you've never heard of before, mm-hmm. you don't know exactly what's called, and you have the name in English or some facsimile of the name. How do you go to the ethnic grocery store and find it? Because it might be dialectically different from the different part of Italy or from a different part of China, and you're lost, right? Her suggestion is, take a picture of it with you, whether you have it from the magazine or you have it online, or go online and find the translations of the word of the item that you're looking for, and be armed with that piece of paper when talking with the shopkeeper in the ethnic restaurant. And it will overcome those language barriers and cultural barriers and even dialectical barriers. And I think that's a fabulous piece of
advice. It's a great idea. The other thing that she mentions frequently in her articles is get to know the person from whom you're buying these things from. Because what will happen is as you develop a relationship, like with almost anything, they'll be excited to show you the new thing. They'll be excited to talk to you about what's going on. And you'll develop a vernacular. You'll develop an ability to ask for what you're looking for because of that relationship that you have.
And that relationship should be an honest relationship. Remember, the shopkeeper works for you and is not likely to be insulted by you saying, yeah, I didn't like that particular vegetable that you liked last week and if you, that you gave me last week. Now, if you're the kind of person who is not that direct or you like to couch something and have a balanced interaction, when you buy things from this grocer, from this who may be introducing you to new things, you can say, yes, you know, I didn't like this one thing that you brought me last week, but I did like this other thing. And then if you have a relationship over time, that purveyor, that grocer, that vegetable grocer, that green grocer, that butcher will get to know what you like and will know that you are adventurous. And, you know, going back and saying, you know, I didn't like this particular thing doesn't mean I never want to try anything new again.
And also, don't be afraid to ask your restaurateur. You ask him, you know, about the great wines on his list. Why not ask him about that great spice or that interesting flavor or that pork belly that you just tried on his menu?
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I know we certainly have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.